you don't have to be a CEO of a company to say, okay, now it's time for me to give back and be your mentor. Everyone has got skills in different areas, whether it's HR, whether it's bookkeeping. And young women need to see the opportunity for them, if they have entrepreneurial aspirations, can be anything they want. And it's not limited to their expertise in a subject area. They can be very good at managing people. They can be very good at supply chain logistics. And that could be something that interests them. I know there are degrees in that field now.
Oh, such a good question.
Well, when you come with these questions, that's another great branding question.
That's a big question.
That's a very interesting question because it really makes you think about what you just did.
Welcome to the Your Living Brand Live Show. This show is all about how you communicate your value, how you build influence through trust, and recognizing who your audience is and who they are not. Through our weekly conversations with our guests, we will explore different ways to enable you to demonstrate your uniqueness while we ask them, what's your story? And now, welcome our host, Ben Baker.
And welcome back to another episode of the Your Living Brand Live Show. Thank you, my wonderful audience, for joining me yet another week. I love that you respond to me on social media. I love that you ask me questions. I love that you think about guests and different things that you want to know. And every single week, I try to come up with things that are going to be responsive to your particular needs. So thank you guys for hanging in another week. This week, I have Liz Serra with us. She is the chair of the National Council of Business Women. And before I bring her on, I want to give you guys two stats. 90% of the 12 million female entrepreneurs in the United States have no employees. So we're talking 10.6 million businesses that are solopreneurs. And of that 10%, 10.6 million solopreneurs, half, and I'm saying half, make less than $10,000 a year. Liz, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ben. I look forward to our conversation. And every time I hear those statistics, it just shocks me that we don't have a bigger piece of this economy, given the numbers that we have of women-owned businesses. And that's really one of the issues that we're tackling at the National Women's Business Council. How do we help all of those solopreneurs take that entrepreneurial leap, take that risk, and hire that first employee?
That's a psychology thing. In a lot of particular cases, you know, being a small business owner, I get it. And I really want to get into this. And before we do, tell me a little bit about you, because I mean, you are an accomplished entrepreneur in your own rights. And let me know a little bit about you and a little bit about the National Council so we can give people some reference about where we're coming from.
Sure. So I've worked in entrepreneurial roles in tech companies my entire career. I have to preface that by saying I don't have a technical or computer science background at all. And there's nothing about software programming and development that interests me. But what does interest me is what technology does and how it changes the way we do our jobs, the way we order food, the way we get a taxi from here to there, whatever we do. And that is the thing that has kept me working for 30 years in the technology space. And most of these companies that I've had roles in, whether they were big companies or ones that I helped to start, all were doing groundbreaking things with technology that hadn't been done before. So we had to figure out, how do we convince people who've never had this opportunity for some piece of automation to change their day-to-day work life or what they do at home, and make them understand how much better it would be or how much more they could get done or how much faster they could get that task accomplished or how much easier it would be to get a ride from here or there. And so that's the part of the technology that always excited me. My background is in business and in marketing in particular. And one of the things that I did with two other co-founders is start a software company in the early 90s. And we were one of the early companies before the intranet even took hold. When that intranet came around in the latter part of the 90s, had to tremendously pivot that company to go from what we were doing in a pre-web world into everything is now shifting to an internet-based economy and business model. And so we did that successfully, built that company up to about 300 employees and maybe 25 million in the course of about 3 years. Ultimately, we wanted to go public, but that's when the dot-com bubble burst in the year 2000, for those of you who are around then. And when we sold the company, because we obviously needed more capital, so even at 25 million in annual sales, we needed money to continue to compete. Things were moving fast. And accidentally, some CEOs in the local DC area where I'm based called up and said, hey, you don't know me, but we've read about you and we don't know why we're not growing our company and why we aren't getting sales. Can you come and help us? So I figured this is going to be a little short stint until I figure out my next startup. And lo and behold, 20 years later, I've been working with technology startups and growth stage companies and helping solve their business challenges and helping them go from being small companies to going to being big companies. So I've been around entrepreneurial endeavors very deeply for the last 20 years. And so that kind of got me involved in the Entrepreneurship Center at the University of Maryland, where I got a master's degree. And I was a chair of that center, which is one of the top 10 in the country, and helps students take those ideas that they might have for businesses of their own and get them executed, get them implemented. And from there, I was then approached by the White House 3 years ago if I would take over as chair of the National Women's Business Council, which is a federal agency that has one sole mission, which is to advocate for women business owners around the country and make recommendations to Congress or the White House or other federal agencies, things that they can do to help women get new businesses off the ground or help the women that already have companies in place get them to the next level. So that's at a very high level what we do.
That's great. What I find interesting is, and I've had other tech entrepreneurs on this show and people in insurtech and fintech, and what I found is that it's not the technology that makes or breaks a company. It's understanding what your clients' needs are and being able to communicate your value and being able to understand, am I truly solving a problem? And that's what makes you magical. That's what makes you profitable. That's what makes you valuable. Your tech stack is your tech stack. It could be a little bit better. It could be a little bit worse than somebody else's. But if you can understand your clients better, if you can communicate with them more effectively, if you can get that trust of your clients, you can grow where other companies can't.
You're so right about that. And that tends to be the number one problem that most early stage tech entrepreneurs come to me for assistance with. Most tech companies are founded by technology gurus. They're great at software development. They've come up with an app or some type of a SaaS platform that helps companies do one thing or another, but they lack the business side and they don't know who needs what they just built. And I can't tell you how often I'm brought into a company where they show me this whiz bang product and they'll say, okay, it's awesome, but who needs it? Like, who do we sell this to? So that becomes the number one project that I help them figure out. What problem does it solve, to your point? And why should somebody need to pay money for it? What's it going to do to help them? And it's amazing to me that currently is still so prevalent because we have to get away from technology for the sake of it, more in the line of technology that provides some type of value or advantage, whether it's to us as home consumers or to business executives.
And it's not just the tech, you know, community. I mean, I use the analogy of the 12-slice toaster all the time, where people create this wonderful 12-slice toaster, but nobody needs it. Unless you've got a family of seven. A buddy of mine's got seven kids. He needs a 12-slice toaster. But how many families truly need this? So it's not just a tech issue. It's an entrepreneurial issue where most entrepreneurs have a great idea. They're driven by a certain philosophy or idea or problem that they think is out there in the world, but they don't know how to translate that to the real world and get other people to think the same way and believe the same things that they do, or they haven't checked to make sure that the world out there has the same problem that they think is actually there.
You're so right. And, you know, the benefit of all of these incubators and accelerators, both the in-person places as well as the virtual ones that have sprung up just over the last 5 years, has served a great purpose in helping these would-be entrepreneurs who might be working full-time in a job in a very big company, but secretly they had this product idea on the side that they really are passionate about, but they don't know how to get it from their head, you know, out onto the street. And so, you know, participating in these programs and these incubators that have all sorts of resources and mentors and advisors available is really helping to shape this whole next generation of businesses that are focused on bringing innovation into the marketplace, affecting so many facets of our life, whether it's just ordering groceries.
No, I think that's great. Let's talk about your three initiatives, because I think that that's a great place to start this conversation, because the initiatives that you have for the National Council are far reaching. And I think that they really, truly help move the needle for women entrepreneurs. So I'll let you explain those three initiatives and then let's dive deep into them.
So one of the first things I had to do once I was appointed chair was to appoint a board. And by legislation, and the council was formed by legislation, by the way, back in 1988. And if you'll allow me, I'll tell a little interesting anecdote about why was this council formed in the first place. In 1988, there were many states that had laws on the books that required a woman business owner who wanted to take out a commercial loan from a bank to have a male relative co-sign the loan. Her father, her uncle, her nephew, her son. A woman alone could not take out a commercial loan.
And this is less than 40 years ago.
It is. It's 1988. I mean, I was in the workforce working on startups and working in entrepreneurial roles. Never even knew that this was part of the business and financial landscape. So a group of women worked with Congress, lobbied Congress, and legislation was introduced that did two things. One, got rid of that requirement. This was in 1988, and it was then signed by President Reagan. And secondly, it created this National Women's Business Council, and it set some guidelines on how this council would function. So every new White House administration would appoint a chair, and that a chair would fill 15 seats on the council with women business owners, 8 of them from around the country with diverse businesses. And then 5 seats would be devoted to women that ran business organizations of women. And then the last seat was always set aside for the chair or president of an organization called the Association of Women's Business Centers, which is an SBA-funded group of 150 centers around the country that offer free advice to women business owners. So I put a council in place, and that took some number of months. And then just based on my own entrepreneurial background as a founder of software companies, as part of a team that worked on a new startup within a big company, there were issues that I faced that I felt everyone else faces, especially my female counterparts. And the big one is access to capital. When we were looking for money for my software startup, we were on the plane, myself and my male co-founder, over to Silicon Valley every other week, talking to venture capital firms. There were no angels in the world at that point in time. There were no grants, so to speak. There were no pitch competitions that we hear about all the time. There were a handful of venture capital firms, and either you convinced them or you didn't convince them. So access to capital is an important business requirement to get a company off the ground, as well as fund growth stage and scale requirements if your company is already there. And the second thing I decided we would focus on as a group really touched home for me, which is I've spent my career in technology, in industry where women make up less than 5% of the founders of all tech companies. Today, I can't even imagine what it was in 1993 when we got my first tech company off the ground. So we've gone from, I don't know, probably 0.01% to 5% today. And that's a long period of time. So what do we have to do to motivate women who have an entrepreneurial aspiration to maybe think outside of their comfort zone and look at starting a company that would have a bigger footprint and a bigger impact than just their neighborhood or their community? So most women business owners tend to have service-oriented businesses. Many of them tend to have boutiques, bakeries, and those large numbers that are in the solopreneur category are personal trainers, dog walkers, graphic designers. All of those services are important. They add vibrancy and interest to the neighborhoods that we choose to live in. But then women as a gender are not ever going to have the kinds of scalable companies that attract large investors and that have impact at a state or a national level. So we need to get women to start companies in STEM-related fields. So that's the second initiative. And the third one really looks at the country as a geographically uneven, dispersed place for entrepreneurism. Entrepreneurism thrives where we've got universities with entrepreneurship centers, where we have companies that are funding job creation and innovation within their company. And when we look at where does this take place, it's on the coast, the East Coast, the Southern Coast, the West Coast. The Midland of country is a challenge. And so my third initiative is how do we help women in rural communities overcome the geographic challenges? And in many cases, it's distance and it's lack of things that we take for granted in big cities, like access to broadband internet and access to incubators and accelerators and mentor networks and business centers that can help with these business ideas. So those are the three things that we've been focusing on over these last 3 years. Each year, we've made various recommendations to different government agencies or the SBA or Congress on things they can do that will better help women get more businesses off the ground and tackle these three initiatives in one way or another.
Do you want to differentiate yourself in your marketplace? Do you want to learn how to tell your story and develop audio and visual content that can be shared across platforms? Then join us for the 30-Day Podcast Challenge. This is 15 videos over 30 days designed to help you not only develop a podcast, but a content strategy. Start when you want, and you have access to the materials for an entire year. Come find us at www.30daypodcastchallenge.com. And don't forget to use the code LAUNCH for your special discount. And I think that's fascinating. And I want to start with a latter point and then work my way back. And I want to start with the broadband internet, because you're right. I mean, we were talking off air. We were talking about Alaska and we're, you know, up in here in Canada, the Yukon, and also through the Midwest. We all assume that everybody has 300 megabytes, that everybody has, you know, high speed internet, access to cheap connectivity, all those type of things, but it's not true. There are places in this country where you just don't have strong internet. And I think that that is an enormously underestimated deterrent for economic growth. I mean, I look at things like my son. My son sitting here in Vancouver, BC, is taking courses online at MIT, at Harvard, other major universities. And what he's doing is he's auditing these classes because he has access to high-speed, you know, video that he can watch the classes online anytime he wants and be able to have the ability to go out and look at that stuff. Not everybody has that access. And because of high-speed internet, you can have a business that is beyond the 30 square miles around your house. So what is the major initiative that you guys are doing to be able to help with that? Because I see that as almost systemic, to be able to hamper growth within the Midwest and within a lot of these rural communities to be able to elevate entrepreneurs, you know, women and men, but in this particular case, women, to be able to allow them to be bigger and expand and get their products to a larger market. So what is the council doing to be able to further the initiatives to help with that technology piece to make things better?
So some of the work that we've done and some of the roundtables that we've been holding around the country in the last year, they've been virtual, but prior to that, they would be in place where we would go into a city and invite women business owners and invite the, what I call the entrepreneurial ecosystem partners in that community. Those could be banks. Those could be SBA office employees. It could be entrepreneurship centers of a community college, the local economic development office. What we've learned is that certain states, especially those in rural areas of the country, have come up with good models of using state money and private money to help fund bringing that internet access, if you will, to that last mile. So it's elevating some of those success stories so that the rest of the communities around the country can see what has worked and what does it take to make those things happen. The current administration does have a very big infrastructure piece in the latest round of bills and initiatives coming from the White House that would ensure that broadband high-speed internet is available to more of the rural communities than it currently is. So we're watching that legislation. We're hopeful that it will start to close the gap and provide that much needed access. Because if you look at not just small businesses that use the internet to sell their goods and services, but even employees in big companies that have had to work remotely over this last year need that same access as well, just to do their job. And so it becomes more of a utility that is essential for our day-to-day business productivity. So we're keeping an eye on what Congress is doing and making sure that our voice is heard as a representative of women businesses in those rural sectors. Another big issue that women in rural communities face is access to childcare. Again, those of us that live in big cities have lots of options.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. It's a challenge in big cities as well. We can't kid ourselves.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that we recommended last year, and I want to get this right, so let me put my glasses on and take a look at it, is ways that we can encourage communities to provide investment incentives to organizations or women that start childcare centers and provide childcare solutions that might not exist today. And, you know, we continue to look at supporting and advocating for federal recovery dollars that need to cover the childcare industry, as well as allowing childcare providers that might be organized as a nonprofit to be able to have small business aid. So currently, that wasn't the case. So even small things like that, that involve just little tweaks to the current laws that are in place. So if a childcare center is a nonprofit, it had not been eligible for federal small business dollars.
Or tax benefits that goes along with it. Exactly.
Precisely. So those are a couple things. But, you know, I'm very excited about some of the things that we're doing in the access to capital, if you will. The year before last year, we spent a good amount of time sharing our feedback with some of the House and Senate small business committees. And a piece of legislation that was introduced that hasn't yet been acted on, and we're hoping that it will be some point this year, would allow for anyone who invested in a small business as an angel investor to receive a federal tax credit on their tax return for 3 years. Well, why is that a good thing? My hope is that it will bring more angel investors to the table, especially in communities that don't have a large network of people that have dollars to spare to invest in businesses. I've been an angel investor in tech companies for about 7 or 8 years in the DC area. But when I look at the small communities that we visited in outside Des Moines, Iowa, or in Nampa, Idaho, there are plenty of successful doctors, real estate attorneys, car dealership owners who might never think of themselves as an angel investor. But if they started to look at some of the tax advantages that making an investment in a local business might do both for them, as well as being able to support their community and the businesses there, we're feeling that the pool of angel investors would grow, more people would be part of it, and more businesses would have access to seed capital from among the people in their community that their businesses will serve going down the road. So we're hoping that that will actually get voted upon at some point soon. And part of that same piece of legislation that was introduced provides the company a tax credit for their very first employee. So in the numbers, Ben, that you reiterated at the top of our conversation, how do we get those 10.6 million women businesses with no employees to take that crucial first step? So capital is important because they know they've got to write that paycheck every 2 weeks and they don't want to end up short and then stuck and then have to let that person go. So a tax credit could go a long way to eliminating some of the fear in getting that first employee on that payroll.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the angel investor community, as you said, are sitting there going, okay, what's the benefit for me? And angels have different motivations. There's no question about it. VCs are a different animal, but angels are, if you can make it tax deductible or at least tax creditable for an angel investor to sit there and say, wait a second, I've got an extra $25,000 this year. Instead of that money going directly to the government in taxes, what if I could invest that money in three or four small businesses? Okay, this one gets 3,000, this one gets 5,000, this one gets 8,000. It doesn't seem like a lot, but to these large, small companies that are making $10,000 a year, it's an enormous amount of money.
It's enormous. And it's the difference between doing nothing for that startup founder to getting the company registered as an LLC or an LLP or an S corp or a C corp, because those filings cost money. It's getting the website up, it's getting the business cards printed, things rolling. For companies that are producing a physical product, it could mean buying the supplies necessary to get that product into the marketplace. And so it's a small number for many people, but given the potential to have it become a tax deduction or a credit against taxes owed, I think can make a difference by bringing more people to the table.
But if you could take those 5 million businesses, even take half of those 5 million businesses that are making $10,000 or less a year, and bring them up to a point where they're actually paying taxes, go from being no tax whatsoever to at least paying some amount of tax, it hopefully would become, you know, revenue neutral for the government, or even be to the advantage of the government to be able to allow that thing to happen. So it's allowing government to work with industry to be creative. And then it's a matter of communicating this to financial planners, to accountants, to that investment community to sit there and say that this is now an opportunity. And when I think that people know that this is an opportunity and they can sit there and say, wait a second, I can be far more tax efficient. I can also be an angel investor and I can also help people get a hand up. There's value to everybody by doing this. So I see that this is a way to be able to bring capitalization in small ways that can add significant value.
It really would be a win-win for everybody, for the investor, for the entrepreneur, and for the community, because more businesses would be available in a way that they can thrive. So that's what we have to support, not just getting the company off the ground, but doing the things that will enable them to grow and to flourish, hire people, make money, come up with more products, do more, get bigger. In other words, go through the company life cycle that, you know, the very large companies have already done and are at their pinnacle. I think we need to do more in terms of access to capital in different ways to help those entrepreneurs not just start the company, but to scale them.
So let's get into scale and let's get into the mentality behind scale and also STEM and how we do that step. How do we get those people to sit there and say, okay, it's now time for me to create a business that's not just a hobby, but it's something that is a viable business that allows me to employ other people. It allows me to elevate, become a part of the tax basis, to be able to make significant contributions to society. Not that, you know, single entrepreneurs don't. I mean, we still need the bakeries. We still need the personal trainers and all the solopreneur businesses. I'm not negating that. If that's where you want to be, if that's what, you know, drives you and that's the business that you want, there's nothing wrong with that. But the people that want to be more, that don't know how to get there, how do we help them? How do we help them learn about the advantages of being able to hire that employee and how to access the capital, how to get involved in the next generation of businesses, the science and technology, the engineering, the math type businesses that allow the economy to grow? Because that's where the economy is going.
Believe me, driverless cars, I think, is just the first step of what we can't even imagine might be in place in 20 years. So I think the first thing that needs to happen is we need to, at a very young age, share with young girls, even at the K through 12 grade levels, that thinking outside of the comfort zone is possible and that they don't have to have a degree in computer science to start a software company or a degree in chemistry to come up with a product that might make clean water more accessible in areas that are poor or don't have the resources for clean filtering and whatever, that a company is made up of a team of people. And when I look at myself, I brought the business experience and expertise to the table. My second co-founder was the software guru. He built the software platform. And my third co-founder was the funder. He had the bankroll that was going to get us off the ground and pay salaries in the beginning and pay the rent for the office and buy the computers and pay for the phone system. And so a company is really about assembling the right team with the set of skill sets that every company needs. And so I had no idea about software development, nor did I want to learn it. But we were the three-legged stool, and there was no overlap in any of the three of our skill sets. So we came together and everybody did their thing, and it worked. And so we've got to get that message to women at a very young age. And one of the ways we can do that is by showing role models. And I think role models are just so critical, not just women who have created and built and currently run successful companies in STEM-related areas, but women of all ethnic backgrounds that are doing that. And when I look at some of the mentor networks that are in place around the country, whether they're government-sponsored, whether they're locally put together by organizations or nonprofits, we need to make sure that there's representation of women that are in STEM fields in those mentor networks and women of diverse backgrounds in those mentor networks. Too often, it's the old guys that have retired from business that are giving their time. Well, I'd like to challenge every woman who is listening to your show today that can become a mentor. You don't have to be a CEO of a company to say, okay, now it's time for me to give back and be your mentor. Everyone has got skills in different areas, whether it's HR, whether it's bookkeeping. And young women need to see the opportunity for them, if they have entrepreneurial aspirations, can be anything they want. And it's not limited to their expertise in a subject area. They can be very good at managing people. They can be very good at supply chain logistics, and that could be something that interests them. I know there are degrees in that field now. So I would just challenge women to step up and become an entrepreneurial advisor. Local colleges around the country are always looking for them to support their student base. And when women that are at the college level see other women that have done it, it gives them that extra boost, that extra piece of confidence that perhaps they can too.
No, it's true. I mean, I volunteer and mentor at a couple of the different universities within the business departments to teach people about communication, networking, personal branding, et cetera. And when we get these large groups of women together, half of the mentors are women. And I love seeing it. I love seeing that half the people in the room are women, and they're diverse women. It's not just white women, women from all backgrounds, and men for that matter. Sometimes I'm minority being a 50-year-old white male in the room, which is great. But it's great to see that there are role models for people to sit there and say, okay, this person's already done this. This is what's possible. And I think that that's what people need. This is possible. Somebody else has already done this. It's not something that I've never seen somebody do this before. It was like when the first female astronaut went up. The eyes that opened, wait a second, women can go into space too, was an amazing thing. And of course, women could go into space, but it took the first one to open the eyes to a lot of people to sit there and say, wait a second here, it's not just men that go onto a spaceship, it's all people that can go onto a spaceship. I think that having active role models in all different areas of life is important. And you're right, you don't need to be the CEO of a $1 billion company to be a mentor. Anybody can mentor because we all have skills that we can share. And I think that that's so important.
It really is. And, I completely encourage everyone to look in your communities for those incubators that are there, the entrepreneurship centers that are associated with schools, and see where you can participate and give an hour a week or half a day a month, whatever it might be, because it will make a difference. And you will get a tremendous amount of satisfaction out of doing it.
Absolutely. Now, Liz, I'm going to ask you one last question, and we'll make sure that your full contact are in the show notes so everybody can get in touch with you and the National Council of Business Women, because I think that the work that you guys do as an organization, and you personally, are vital. I mean, it truly is. But the question I'm going to ask you is, when you leave the room and you leave a meeting and you get in your car and you drive away, what's the one thing you want people to think about you and the organization when you're not there?
So that's a tough one. I'd say entrepreneurship is a risky venture, but you're never going to know if you can do it if you don't try. And so there's a baseball analogy that I always think about when I'm about to do something very high risk. And that is, and since we just started baseball season, I'm a big fan, you can't steal second base by keeping one foot on first. So if you have any entrepreneurial aspirations, give it a try. You'll never know unless you do.
I love it. Liz, thank you for being an inspiration. Thank you for being on the show. And thank you for your words of wisdom. I've loved every minute of this.
Thank you, Ben. It's been a real pleasure, and I've enjoyed our conversation.
This has been the YourLivingBrand.live show. I want to thank you for tuning in today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show at YourLivingBrand.live and share your favorite episodes with colleagues and friends. At Your Brand Marketing, we help companies engage, retain, and grow their most valuable assets, their employees. If you're tired of losing great staff and want to retain your best employees, build brand champions and leaders at any level. Contact us for a 30-minute consultation at yourbrandmarketing.com. That's www.yourbrandmarketing.com. Thank you again for listening and sharing. Tune in next week when we ask another guest, what's your story?